No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was an amazing group of women from the District of Columbia. I want to brag a little bit. Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. And we have a really, really, really great guest tonight, former D.C. Mayor Sharon Pratt. Sharon Pratt was elected mayor in 1990. She's a native Washingtonian, which is less rare today than it was, but used to be very rare. And she was the first African-American woman to hold a position like this in the United States. Just amazing. So we're going to have a conversation with her about that and other things. Her latest project is the Institute for Politics, Policy, and History. And so let's start there. Welcome to the show, Mayor Pratt. Welcome back. And thanks for being with us.
Well, it's a delight to be with you, Senator. You do such a great job on behalf of statehood, so I'm honored and pleased to be with you today.
Well, that you know, for full disclosure, let me tell you that Mayor Pratt and I worked together at one time, although she may not remember it. She was a treasurer of the DNC, and I was one of the, I don't even know what the, I was a staffer, but, you know, I was one of those do whatever they tell you to do on any particular day kind of staff person, you know. I mean, I ran a Xerox machine. I ran the switchboard. I ran direct mail. It was just a crazy place to work. And my boss, maybe somebody you would remember, Ursula Culver, was just an amazing person, the comptroller. She was this tough German lady that whipped us all into shape. But let's start.
It was a fun era. You know, we were sort of everyone coming of age on a lot of big issues with women's rights, you know, and minority rights, and you know, it was the halcyon years with the Democratic Party.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, there was such an esprit de corps in the place because we were small. We were less funded than the Republicans were. And, you know, we always felt like we were in a fight and we really bonded together closely with some amazing people. Well, you know, I was on staff with Terry McAuliffe and Mark Warner and, you know, Ann Lewis. And I mean, just amazing, amazing people. So speaking
no,
of
it
amazing,
was a great time.
Yeah, it really was. And let's start by talking about IPPH. I get I see you on Twitter all the time and I see your guests and I think this is just an amazing thing that you're doing because it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you're really taking a kind of an interdisciplinary approach to talking about the history of DC, that you're talking about music and you're talking about politics and you're talking about people and history. So explain that to us. What are you trying to do with that?
Right. Well, you know, I'm very honored to be the founding director of the Institute of Politics, Policy, and History, which was started in large measure by Mayor Bowser, along with the president of the University of District of Columbia, Ron Mason, for two purposes. The biggest one is to rediscover the history of Washington, D.C., put a pin in that because I'm coming back to it, and the other of which was to sort of do a deep dive into some of the touchstone issues that have perennially plagued our nation, And there's a confluence with that. So I won't go on and on, but that is the purpose of IPPH. And because of that, we try to sort of excavate that history around the music of our city, the art of our city, the politics of our city, the written word in the city, you know, all of that history, which is so important, and has defined the character and culture of the city.
Well, you know, it seems to me, I used to get this great magazine every month from the Historical Society, which they don't do anymore, but Washington has this rich, rich history that a lot of times we don't really fully understand for two reasons. One, I think because we have such a fluid population of people coming in and out, but also because we're so focused on national politics. And many years ago, I started a website that's still out there called Teach Democracy, to talk about DC and our struggle, because I think there are so many lessons to be learned about national politics from what's happened here in DC, right? I mean, we've been at the center of so many things. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, I think you have to begin with how we got to be the capital. So, you know, I think most people don't understand that. Of course, the capital during the Revolutionary War was Philadelphia, which was one of the largest city among the colonies, the second largest city in all of the Great Britain Empire. And so many thought that naturally that would continue to be the capital. It's sort of a long story, mainly because of the yellow fever. Eventually they, and something else, they started rotating the capital. And by the time George Washington was inaugurated, our first president, the capital was in New York City. And of course, New York thought, just like London, the commercial capital ought to also be the political capital. Well, as the story goes, the reason we ended up being the capital, which at that time was just the town of George. I mean, we really weren't much of a venue, was because our founding fathers wanted the capital in the South. And the reason they wanted it in the South is that there was a concern about Pennsylvania, which was the favorite, was leaning towards abolition. And so as a consequence, that one of those issues that have perennially plagued our nation, we ended up being the capital in the South, you know, here along the banks of the Potomac, in large measure, not exclusively, but in large measure, to protect that institution of slavery. So we here in the district are an expression of America, the best of who she is, without a doubt, but also that underbelly, the issues that have plagued us and torn at us since our inception.
Yeah, and beyond that theme, you know, what you just talked about, that continued because the District of Columbia was drawn in a perfect square, which it no longer is, because Virginia demanded, you know, Virginia wanted their piece of the District of Columbia. For people that don't know, the land that the District of Columbia was founded on was donated by Virginia and Maryland. But Virginia wanted their piece back, right? Because they knew we were going to end slavery.
That's exactly right. At retrocession, I think, was 1847.
Yeah.
In anticipation, because there was a buildup. We talk about the violence of today. There was a building violence really in the Capitol, you know, where people were getting caned on the floor of the Congress, because these tensions were building. And so during that period of time, Virginia, Alexandria opted to, for retrocession.
Well, I wish you hadn't told me that, because there's a couple of people in Congress I wouldn't mind caning these days. But, but you know, this leads us to where we are today. Today is the only holiday, official holiday in the District of Columbia. It's actually Emancipation Day. It's kind of funny that we've been doing Emancipation Day, activities all weekend, you know, to commemorate this day. And today is the actual day. And it's when Lincoln actually did first free the slave, right? He bought the only only compensated emancipation in American history, maybe in all history. He bought 3,100 slaves and set them free. Kind of, was that a PR move on his part?
Well, no, it was because it was the only, I'm sorry, I cut across you, but it was the only place we had the authority to do it.
Yeah.
Where it was clearly that it was unequivocal, he had the authority over the District of Columbia. And so there was increasing, because originally the Civil War was not really defined entirely about ending slavery. But ultimately, in part because of military advantage and economic advantage, the North began to say, hey, why should we allow the South to have the economic advantage of enslaved people? And so eventually they said, you know, we need to emancipate. And the place, and remember, they did not emancipate any border states, so Maryland and Kentucky.
Right.
You know, they didn't emancipate enslaved people there. Only in the states where there were of the Confederacy. But they began the process of demonstrating emancipation by doing it here, where it was clear that he had the authority in the District of Columbia.
Well, one thing I've always wondered, and maybe you can answer this question, is that when Emancipation Day first happened, it was a big deal. The President of the United States used to come to the Emancipation Day parade. You know, it was a really, really big deal, especially for Black people in Washington. But then it died for years. The whole idea of it, I mean, it was always there, but we didn't really celebrate it, or commemorate is a better word, I think. We didn't commemorate the day. And then a lovely lady named Loretta Carter Haynes, who was kind of keeper of the flame, right? She kept it going. Brought it upon the city council, who made it an official holiday. So do you know why it lost popularity all of a sudden? For the first few years after the Civil War. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I can't speak to it with authority as to why it lost popularity, but I think it was probably always problematic. You know, at an event we had, Professor Hassan Jeffries, who by chance is also the brother of the minority leader, Hakeem Jeffries, who's a great historian, Hassan. And he said, you know, in America, we don't like history. We like nostalgia. We don't like real history. We like nostalgia. And so as a consequence, when we look back, I mean, if you look at your history books, which is why, you know, part of why we have to do something about rediscovering the history of Washington, D.C., you know, and I know, if you Google Washington, D.C., and say you want the history, you're going to get a lot of books about monuments, but not about the history, the culture, the people of the city. And you look at American history, you don't really learn the true history of our country. Where there's much about us that's just be celebrated. But America, a part of that history is clearly, women are not a part. Most history books, you don't find many women in the history books. You mean, you only see us in there sewing a flag. You know, you don't learn about the Spanish culture that clearly had a role in building this country, which is why we have cities named Los Angeles and San Francisco. Obviously, you know, there was a strong Spanish presence, or that the first group to be excluded were the Chinese, all of, you know, and absurdly, not the painful history of one of the worst forms of slavery in the history of the world, which happened here in America. And that this was the economic engine for America. It was more than people discriminated against. It had everything to do with the net worth of these individuals, which is why they were willing to do anything to protect it. None of that is the part. So I guess I'm saying, why would you celebrate Emancipation Day? If you do celebrate Emancipation Day, you've got to go back and look at the 247 years prior to that, where you bred and bartered human life. I don't think America wants to always look at that history.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I must tell you, just a personal experience of mine was, I remember watching the movie Amistad. And I'm sure you know this thing in history about the boat that came from Cuba and was seized, and they went to the case went to the court, and they were act, these people were actually, represented by the former president of the United States. And I had never, when I saw that movie, I said, I didn't know anything about this. I have a master's degree in public policy. I've never heard of this. You know,
no, well, so I wasn't, many, I didn't know that until, actually, the movie as well. John, was it John Quincy Adams, I think, was his story.
Yeah,
John
Quincy Adams, yes, exactly.
Yeah, no, this, all that history gets lost, and people who've made a contribution, including for our own community, their contribution gets lost. And yeah, while we're delighted that the city is growing and maturing and we have an influx of individuals, we tend to rename neighborhoods, paper over that history. And it's terribly important that we go back and acknowledge these individuals. That's what I enjoyed about the mayor's luncheon for emancipation, where she went back. You know, they had a slideshow of people that have contributed, yeah, like Calvin Rolark and others, you know, John Wilson, Dave Clark, yeah, and others, and Arrington, yeah, Dixon, and yeah, others, who yeah made a contribution to this community. And you see why the indigenous people get so annoyed. And here you had a great nation of the Piscataway Nation who were here 13,000 years, not 13,000 years. They made it a capital long before anybody with Madison and Jefferson and others decided it ought to be a capital. They had a capital here. They used what became the major crop for Jefferson, Madison, and Washington and others, tobacco. They only used it for a spiritual activities, not as you know, something by which to barter. And they really, so they had a strong presence, a defining presence in this region, and they really, really feel we totally marbled over their history in a way that is extraordinarily disrespectful. So, you know, I agree with Professor Hassan Jeffries. We don't really like history. We like nostalgia. We like, you know, we who won the West, you know, and how we were just, we were never pure, but that doesn't take away from the strength and the goodness and the potential of America. But there is also, other dimensions to it that we must honor.
Yeah. And, you know, we see that going on now. Don't we see that going on now where Republicans are saying, they're out there beating the bushes saying, yeah, we need to go back to the good old days, you know? Well, the good old days were only good old days for some people. They weren't good old days for everybody, right? They weren't good old days yeah for women. They weren't good old days for minority groups. They were good old days for nice white guys like me. And that really appeals to a lot of people, I think, you know, they say, yeah, you know, I remember the days when, everybody stood up and sang the national anthem. And, you know, there are certainly good pieces to that. And as my dad always used to say, no, there's truth in every good lie. There's some truth in every good lie. And I think that unfortunately politicians are playing on that right now. And you're right. We have to remember these things because those of us that don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Are we not? And I think it's great, by the way, I just want to add this, that IPPH is at UDC, which is a historically black, college. If I'm not mistaken, it may be the oldest HBCU in America, is it?
I don't think it's the oldest, but you could be right there. It's certainly
very old.
At Howard, for example, it was in 1850, I think, the university, well, an element of it was established.
Right.
But Howard was 1867, but it's also the state university. I mean, you have the University of Maryland, you know, you have the University of Virginia. We are the equivalent with the University of the District of Columbia. In fact, in our research, we discovered that George Washington left shares of the Potomac Company. He was a tremendous, he believed very much that this region, the Chesapeake Bay, would be the gateway to the West. What ultimately became the Erie Canal became the gateway to the West. Mm-hmm. But that was his hope, and that had a lot to do also with why he was so keen on making the political capital here along the banks of the Potomac. Well, that some of his shares, he had left and earmarked it to establish a University of the District of Columbia, as his fate would have it. I don't know what happened to that, but it didn't happen then. But he, too, had wanted, as Jefferson did, as you know, establish University of Virginia. He wanted a university for the District of Columbia.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that we have one. I'm glad that it's still tied into the community. I think that the work you're doing there is so important. But can we change gears a little bit and talk about what's going on today in Congress? It's so frustrating. I mean, you understand that recently the crime bill, which was thrown out of Congress, was sent up to Congress to be approved, as all our laws have to be. And for the first time in 30 years, Congress rejected it. We ended up losing 65 Democrats. We painted the President of the United States into a corner. It's just because I think my personal opinion is they want to make a whipping boy out of the District of Columbia. Because as you said, Lincoln could do what he did with the slaves because he had the power, and they have the power. And I think they want to mess with us more than they usually do. What do you think of that? You think we're in for a firestorm of this stuff?
I think with the numbers growing of the senators, we got that first vote on statehood when I was in office. And now since then, we've had on two occasions, the House has supported it, which is quite a feat. And now is what, you've had, 46 senators?
Yes.
I think who co-signed, the legislation for it. As you, Mitch McConnell and others have expressed, have made statehood a big issue for them. They're not crazy. They know that those two votes will end up being Democratic votes, certainly progressive votes. And they do not want the District of Columbia to have statehood. And as you know, to a great extent, the way the Constitution was set up, and keep in mind, again, our founding fathers, who had the vision to think of us a form of self-governance. But it was a type of a system where they never had a lot of confidence in that sort of John and Jane, or it wasn't Jane, Jane couldn't vote. They didn't have confidence in white men who didn't have land, who didn't have wealth. And so they set up that electoral college system, which also meant that in case they didn't like outcomes, they may have a chance to still control. I say all that to say with the Senate being the way it was organized, we have a system where you don't necessarily, particularly without real full representation, which you do not have when 700,000 citizens do not have representation, they know that they want to keep a grip. The demographics of the country is changing, rapidly becoming much more a nation of ethnic of minorities, or there's no one group that is the majority of it soon, that they're much more progressive thinkers in America. And so as a consequence, if you have a party that basically has been a very homogeneous kind of party that represents, to a great extent, white men of circumstances, you've got to be alarmed. And so they were determined to do anything they can to chip away from the gains we've been making towards actually becoming or getting a vote for statehood. And so they seized this moment around an issue where they knew Biden was caught in the crosshairs. In my opinion, I may not be popular with my friends in the district, but I think Biden would have been in a heck of a position had it looked like he was supporting something that looked like we were being less than aggressive on crime. I agree with Paul Butler. I've had the privilege to get to know him. He was on that commission. He did a beautiful op-ed piece about it, saying that the reduction in penalties for carjacking were pretty much reflective of the trends within the country and that it was not going to be soft on crime. But, you know, perception is everything in politics. Yeah. And had Biden not taken that move, it might have worked even more to our disadvantage, in my opinion, because then we would have become the poster child, unfairly, but we would have become the poster child for being soft on crime. So it just was, we have to be ever so smart about how we keep marshaling the kind of political will to achieve statehood. It is within our reach now. It is within our reach, which is why Republicans are so crazy in their attack and intruding upon the prerogatives of the District of Columbia. They know the danger of having two voting senators from the District of Columbia.
Well, and that's absolutely true. And you know, I was critical of the city council because the mayor vetoed the bill. The mayor vetoed the bill on the basis of a couple of provisions that she was disturbed by, but certainly, you know, that the Congress used, the carjacking thing, the reduction of you know, penalties for serious crimes. We should have known that they were going to go after that. And I think the mayor did know that they were going to go after that, but she, vetoed the bill and they overrode her veto immediately and sent it up there. And I think they did it without thinking it completely through. I think she was right about that. And, but you're right. The criminal code was 100 and so, over 100 years old. Anything over 100 yeah. years old needs to be adjusted. You know, you need to edit anything that's, especially given the history that you've already pointed out. Really was not about everybody in America. It was about a select group. So there was a lot in the crime bill that makes sense. My only problem was is they sent it up to the wrong people. We've got people up there go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, it was not that they were so crazy, but once you sense the political optics were going to kill you, and right. that you were being set up for Congress to have a right to intrude. And though Biden had said he would never step into it, it was, in my opinion, and maybe I'm too generous, but I just think he felt that it had he not signaled that he would not, that he, you know, wouldn't, block it or veto if Congress stepped in. He would have been wrapped around his neck that he was soft on crime because of the political optics, not because of the reality. And the same thing would have been, and frankly, we would have been ensnarled in it as well. We would have been the poster child, unfairly, but nevertheless, political optics. Political optics do matter. And we've got to be as absolutely. Smart as we can be if we're going to get statehood. So, I think, unfortunately, we may have walked into a trap. I know the members of the council would take me to task for it, and I get it. I mean, they're dealing with it every day. But from where
I
sit...
Yeah, well, we did walk into a trap, you know, and he really had no other choice, of course. I mean, you know, political optics. I remember the day that Walter Mondale stuck his head out of that tank, and we all went, oh my God, that's not going to work.
Oh yeah, you're talking about Dukakis.
I'm sorry, Dukakis. Mike Dukakis. And, you know, sometimes something as little as that, you know, something as small as that can be a determining factor. You remember when George Bush was looking at his watch during the debate. Yeah. And we ran a campaign at the DNC that said, time to go. And we put that picture everywhere, you know. Yeah, optics is unfortunate.
Political optics. And Paul Butler, for example, as I said, who is a member of that commission, is a very thoughtful, brilliant man. And he, you know, had a beautifully presented op-ed about how that was a sound set of recommendations. But it wasn't, and you can carry it too far, worrying about political optics. You can compromise your principles, which people would say, worrying about political optics. But I think in the shorter run, that it would have been smart to have avoided this, trajectory, because, we've got a bunch of crazies in the house. And we don't have a leader. I mean, you know what, 15 ballots? Would you get up and be happy after 15 ballots?
Yeah.
You know, raving? Yeah. You know, I don't think so. So, I mean, we don't have a leader. We had a heck of a leader with Nancy Pelosi, but they don't come along very often. So as a consequence, you've got a crazy environment where the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the like of the world, and Jim Jordan is no friend of the District of Columbia. So why walk into that trap, in my opinion? But, you know, I could be, obviously, that's just my opinion.
Well, and I agree with that 100%. My blood pressure used to go up 30 points when I would sit there and listen to Jim Jordan say things in committee hearings about the district, like we couldn't be a state because we didn't have a movie theater, we didn't have a car dealership, and we didn't, you know, and we didn't have a bowling alley. You know, I actually, you know, in a discussion once said to him that I know for a fact that 35 states were entered into the union without a car dealership because the car hadn't been invented yet. So I don't know, you know, when that became a criteria. But yeah, they're crazy. And you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene has said that we're a crime-ridden hellhole, and we need to have our government disbanded. I mean, it's just crazy. It's crazy. I can tell you. People in my neighborhood feel safe, and people in Washington, D.C. in general feel safe, although crime is on the rise, unfortunately, like every big city. You know,
every major city. Yeah, every major city. And, you know, there's a lot of economic shifts going on in our society. Yeah. And in that environment, you often creates a lot of anxiety. I mean, that doesn't mean that you don't need to be aggressive about addressing it, which I think the mayor is. But they are part of a party that is no longer a mainstream party. I mean, this is a party that in the wake of an insurrection on the 6th of January, where people's lives were at stake, where they were trying to hang the vice president of the United States and looking to kill the speaker of the house, where they were on a floor terrified, still in the wake of that, came back in there. At least Mitch McConnell brought him back and Pence went there. What was it? 147 members still voted not to certify an election. I mean, these are brown shirts straight out of pre-Nazi Europe. That's where we are. We don't have a mainstream Rockefeller or Romney or the Bush kind of Republican Party anymore. We are fighting for the soul of America. And that's why it's so intense. And that's why we've got to be smart. And that's why we can't afford to be bickering with each other. We need to close ranks, whether we like each other or not, because we are fighting for the soul of America. They are really terrified of a progressive, inclusive America. And you can't have an inclusive America if you have 700,000 Americans who do not have a right to vote and who are not represented in this country.
I know. And let me, since you brought it up, let me just mention on Emancipation Day that one of the reasons Madison gave for control over the District of Columbia, for taking control of the nation's capital, was to protect the Congress from insurrections. So obviously that's, you know, that's a moot point. We don't need to, they don't need to control the district to control that.
Had the mayor been able to get the National Guard activated, we might have been able to avoid some of the drama and dilemma that we experienced on the 6th of January. Quite deliberately, obviously, the executive branch under President Donald Trump sat on that request for hours. The District of Columbia should have had the head of our government should have had the authority to activate the National Guard. For me, in my time in office, and I always cared about this in an obsessive kind of way, coming up here, born here, and knowing that we were treated as second-class citizens, I thought I was upset about representation. But once I got in office, I really understood sovereignty mattered even more, because that's what the council and the mayor experienced recently with the ability of a Congress to ignore our will and change our decision making. It's that notion of sovereignty. We don't have anything with which to bargain. I mean, Eleanor Holmes Norton doesn't have any chips with which to bargain. We have no votes. We have no authority. We have no last word. All we have are the responsibilities of citizenship with none of the assets that should come with citizenship. We are, and it hurts Maryland and Virginia for us not to have that sovereignty, to have no chip with which to bargain. And so it is a fight to the death. It is a fight for the soul. And that's why we've got to be as smart as we can be. We are a major player in determining the future of our democracy and the future of this country. Believe me, we should not diminish it. We are an important part of that narrative. And that's why statehood is such a big issue, and why those Republicans have gone crazy about it, because we don't have the Republican Party of the past, the Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln. We've got a Republican Party of brown shirts.
Well, you know, we should point out that it was the Metropolitan Police, the D.C. Police, that actually saved the day when the Capitol Police, who are an amazing police force, they're really an amazing police force, but they were overwhelmed. And if the D.C. Police hadn't come in at the end, I think the consequences would have been even more dire. So, I'll tell you, Mayor, you're one of the most eloquent spokespeople for this cause, and you're absolutely right. And let me ask you, though, this is something that perplexed me from day one. As somebody that worked for Jimmy Carter, was a Democratic, worked on at the Democratic National Committee for years and was a consultant to the Democratic Party for 25 years, the Republicans, as you say, are so afraid of this. How come the Democrats, how come we spent $800 million to get two senators from Georgia, but the Democratic Party really doesn't put as much effort into getting two liberal Democratic senators from the District of Columbia?
It boggles the mind. I absolutely say it boggles the mind. Here we are. We've got young people terrified to go to school because we won't engage in gun control. I mean, I feel for these kids. I mean, this is the number one cause of death for young people, and we can't have any form of gun control. I mean, where I am now at this point, we should have very aggressive gun control. But even though more Americans want it than, you know, overwhelmingly want it, the will of the people will not be expressed, because why? We have a Senate that does not represent fully the popular vote in the United States of America. Here we are in 2023, the era of designer babies, and yet you have state after state and a Supreme Court that was appointed by a very sort of stacked Senate again, that doesn't represent the will of the people, that ignores a woman having a right to control her own body. In 20, 23. What are we talking about? I mean, it's not as if you can't produce children. You don't need to have this kind of madness. What is it that you've got to have control of a woman's body in 2023? The will of the people is ignored. Why? Because you do not have the full expression of that will in the United States Senate. You know, you can go after issue after climate change, issue after issue, but you have a Senate that does not reflect the popular will of the people. And one way to achieve a Senate that reflects the popular will of the people is to have a Senate that represents all of the people by having the two senators from the District of Columbia. And why the Democrats don't make it a do or die issue. I mean, it should be a do or die issue because they try to get things done, beg to get things done. They have a filibuster and they can't get these things done. Doggone it. Do as the Republicans would do. The heck with it. Push it through. Make it happen. And right now you've got a senator who can flip on you. I don't know why. Cinema and the like. We could compensate for all of that by having two. It's in America's interest, not in our interest alone. It's your interest, my interest, our relatives' interest, our neighbors' interest. It's in America's interest. It ought to be a major, major priority for this country. And why the Democrats don't get it, I'll never know.
Well, I've been banging that drum for a long time and said, look, if you believe in a woman's right to choose, if you believe in that people should be able to love and marry who they want. If you know, the two senators from the District of Columbia would make, if you believe in these issues, two more senators from the District of Columbia could make all the difference. It perplexes me as well. I have no idea why they don't go at it more actively. Have the Republicans painted themselves into a corner here? I have two daughters. My daughters are absolutely outraged at what's gone on with the woman's right to choose, the Supreme Court decision. And they've always been politically active, but even now more so. And I pick up the paper today in Washington Post. I see all these women out protesting. Have the Republicans shot themselves in the foot with this? Is this going to hurt them, you think, significantly in the election in 2024?
You know, well, it certainly helped in this last election. They should have won by more significant margins in the House. And we were able to actually gain a seat, as it were, you know, in the Senate. So I think it will ultimately, but they're counting on the fact of Democrats being splintered. They have such a tenuous grip on power. And what they must do is energize a base in order to have any kind of shot. And that base is a base that is, in my opinion, radical in their thinking. I call them the brown shirts because it's equivalent to me of the brown shirts, where you don't worry about what the people want. It's what you think they ought to have. And that's sort of the collective thinking. I mean, reflected by 147 members of the Congress in the wake of almost being killed, still vote not to certify the election of a man who obviously won, not a man that was such an aberration. So, you know, in many ways, a good old boy and a nice one I'm happen to be very fond of, Joe Biden, still did not want to even certify his election. Now, if you have that kind of mindset, you know you're just dealing with a group that says my way or the highway, not unlike what they did in 1860 when the country split. That was my way or the highway. And are so confident that they would be so united that they would win. And as it was what, more death in the Civil War than any war. So that is the mindset with which we are dealing. And it's not just around issues of race, it's around issues of equality, a progressive kind of notion of America that at the end of the day seemingly threatens a certain group's grip on power in this country, or their perceived grip on power in this country, which is why they fight, what, history. My goodness, yeah. If you actually had authentic history, then you would know that we all have made a contribution, such as people such as the Piscataway Nation. I mean, we act as if everything just began, when the Plymouth Rock, you have people here thousands of years. You can't really sell it. You can't sell the superiority of a group if everybody knows the full history of the nation. And I just think we're at such a crossroads in terms of who will have a grip on power. Will that power be shared? Will it be inclusive? And that's why, again, you and I are of the mind, and why I don't understand the Democratic Party, that the fate of the District of Columbia is the fate of America. It is the fate of America. We are the canary in the coal mine. And ultimately, our destiny is America's destiny. And because we are at that kind of crossroads, they are willing to take it all out. You know what I mean? They tell you, we're going to fight. And if we have to go to war, we'll go to war. And a part of America's, it took America almost 3.5 years in the middle of the Civil War to say, hey, maybe we ought to emancipate the enslaved, because then we'll have the economic and military advantage of these individuals. It took them that long to do what should have been transparent at the outset. And I think the same thing operates here regarding our fate and our destiny for the District of Columbia.
Well, and you know, as you point out, them playing to their base, that's one of the first things that I ever learned in politics, was the old expression that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. We fight with our, Will Rogers said, I belong to no organized political movement. I'm a Democrat. And that's so true sometimes. I mean, even, you know, not to digress here, but even what you were talking about earlier about the president, I saw people online, criticizing the president for his veto. And I kept thinking to myself, what do they think President Trump or President DeSantis is going to be more likely to make DC a state than Joe Biden? I mean, really, you know, we tend to unfortunately shoot ourselves in the foot too much. Well, before I
I got upset with a lot of Democratic presidents who wouldn't wear the voting without representation tag and the like. I got very annoyed with them. And people could take my point of view to task. I certainly get it. I feel that we've got a big issue at hand. As I said earlier, we're fighting for the soul of America, and we are that canary in the coal mine. We are, statehood is that, and we've got to be aware of our significance. Critical, important player we are at this time in American history. So I get why people got annoyed with President Biden, but I happen to think, as you do, that we are at a very vulnerable point in the history of our country.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I grew up, you know, in the 1960s and 70s. My first political activities were marching against the war in Vietnam, because I was 18 years old. I was among the first 18-year-olds. I was the first class of 18-year-olds to vote in a presidential election. I was absolutely sure that George McGovern, I would wake up the morning after the election, and all the 18-year-olds in America would have driven George McGovern to victory. And I was absolutely shocked to find out that only me and about 12 other people voted for him. But, but, you know, Yeah, I've never seen a country this divided, and I think you're absolutely right. And I think the fight, and that's why I want to see us do more. I want to, you know, I wrote in a piece for the Washington Post a few weeks ago. This is not, statehood is not a negotiation. It's a fight. We're in a fight. We're not going to negotiate these people into making the District of Columbia state. We're going to have to stand up, and more than 200 of us are going to have to show up for a rally. And we're going to, you know what I'd like to do, Mayor? Now you tell me if you think this is crazy. I thought about all the lunch counter sit-ins. What if we get 500 Washingtonians in DC statehood t-shirts to go in and occupy the cafeteria in the House of Representatives? Just sit in there, not order anything. Just, you know, what are they going to do? They can't arrest all 500 of us. You think that's crazy?
Well, no, I don't. I think that or enough people who can shut down traffic on Pennsylvania Avenue and the like.
Just
because
stand
I
in front
think
of
it would
the-
bring attention because most of the world doesn't know that we don't have any votes. They don't know of our dilemma. But I think also, if I may say, Senator, is that we're like Ukraine. If Ukraine falls, potentially you have a domino effect in terms of democracy, in terms of more authoritarian nations intruding upon the democratic freedom of other nations. Ukraine is more than a fight for Ukraine. It is a fight for democracy. And we need for Americans to understand for statehood is the fight for the future of democracy in America. It is not just our fight. And now, the good thing about what you suggest, and certainly I share in that strategy, is to bring attention for the world to understand this plight. But it is not just, again, our plight. It is like Ukraine. Our future is the world of democracy's future. And I think it's got to be framed that way, and understood that way. And finally, the mayor has been able to get some members of Congress from Maryland and others, some of whom were great friends to me, like Stanny Hoyer, who only recently, or not somewhat more recently than, you know, certainly when I was in office, who got on board with statehood. So I think you have a united, effort now within the DMV of this region. It's got to be more than our fight. And it is appropriately more than our fight, very much like Ukraine. I think it's got to be understood that way.
Well, that's the perfect place to end this. And I thank you so much for being on our show. And I hope you come back again sometime. We always leave the show with a song dedicated to our guests and to the people of Washington, D.C. on Emancipation Day. Thank you, Mayor Pratt. Here's a song from John Mayer, Waiting on the World to Change, except that Sharon Pratt isn't waiting. She's out there trying to change the world. And God bless you for doing that. We'll see y'all next week. Thank you so much. All right.
My pleasure.
Give the people their right to vote.